All right, welcome back to the show. Thank you guys so much for joining us, and have our special guest with us today to give us a preview of what's going on in 2020, talk about what's currently happening and what happened in 2019, and also to talk to us about the imploding dollar. It's dropping like a rock. Anyway, without further ado, Brent Johnson, the head and proprietor of Santiago Capital, running his firm out of San Francisco. Brent, thank you so much for joining us. It's great to have you back on the show, pal.
Yeah, happy New Year. I'm glad to be back, and hope everything's been well with you.
Yeah, it has. We had a nice break, and getting back at it, and certainly not a lack of things to discuss. And obviously, I was very much tongue-in-cheek, but Brent, when is this uncontrollable collapse in the U.S. dollar that so many people are looking for? Wait, is that upon us? What's happening there?
Well, I think you and maybe some of your listeners who have heard me talk before won't be surprised to hear me say that this is, you know, all a figment of people's imagination. I just don't believe that we're going to see this big, you know, move lower in the dollar. Now, I can't say I wouldn't be surprised if it sold off a little bit here over the next 6 to 9 months. But this idea that the dollar is going back to the low 80s, or it's going to be hyperinflated away, or that, you know, the rest of the world is going to, you know, disband from the dollar and reject it and it's going to go to zeros, I think it's based in a tiny bit of fact, but it's unfortunately lost in the real world. And I'm happy to kind of go into more detail of why that is. But, you know, I believe the dollar is going much, much higher over the next couple of years. I think we're kind of on the verge of a global sovereign bond and currency crisis. And when that, you know, gets into full swing, I expect the dollar to go much higher.
Well, you know, the first reason that, you know, we had you on as a guest is, you know, where I'm at on there. I completely agree with you. And before we get into that, because I definitely want to revisit that, just because I don't have nearly as you know, many followers on social media, and I'm not on Real Vision like you, but I have gotten a taste of some of these trolls. These, if you come out and say the dollar's not going to collapse, it's almost like you slap their mother. And and when I was interviewing Dave Collum last week, I thought about you during the interview because he said something really interesting. We were talking about climate change and finance in general. And he referenced the idea that I don't want to get too baked into a philosophy or a view on this because it's nearly impossible to get out of it. And I don't think you and I have had this conversation. I've got my own story, but were you a massive dollar bear from 2009 to about 2012, maybe 2013?
Yeah, I guess that's probably a fair way to put it. I definitely thought the dollar was going to go lower, and in fairness, it did from right. 2008 or 9 to 2011. I think it did go lower. I can't remember right off the top of my head, but I think it went from, let's say, 90 down to 80 or something like that. I'm talking about the DXY index.
Right.
And, you know, I didn't think, and at the time, I didn't think that the Fed would ever stop printing. But the fact is they did. You know, and most people, you know, even though the Fed has kind of gone back and started providing liquidity again here in the last 6 months, most people just cannot accept the fact that they did stop printing in 2014, and they actually started raising interest rates in 2015. And they didn't just raise interest rates once. They raised interest rates 9 times. Now, most of the people who said the dollar is going to go to zero and the Fed's going to print to oblivion and we're going to have hyperinflation, they didn't think that the Fed would be able to raise rates even 1 time. And after the first rate cut, they said, that's it. They won't be able to do another one. And after the second one, they said, that's it. They won't be able to do another one. They did it 9 times, right? And so it was around 2014-15 where I kind of started thinking, maybe I don't have this entirely correct. And, you know, in 2016, I really, really dug into it, and I put out a presentation. I'm going to reference a presentation because I get asked about it all the time, but I put out a presentation in the summer of 2016 called Step Into Liquid, where I went through these, you know, 5 or 6 different factors that were going to affect, you know, the global markets and currencies. And, you know, I kind of came to the conclusion out of doing that the dollar was not only going to go up, but it was going to get a lot stronger. And I, my main conclusion out of the end of that was that we were going to have, this global sovereign debt crisis, currency crisis, and that we would eventually enter into a time period when both the dollar and gold rose together. And that was, at the time, people thought I was absolutely crazy. And I think a lot of people still think I'm crazy. But I do think, whether we're there now or whether that's still to come, I do think that we're going to get into this period of time where the two biggest safe havens, which are the dollar and gold, will rise together. And we've started to see that a little bit here in the last couple of years, or in the last year, gold outperforming dollar over the last, call it 6 months, 9 months, or something like that. But whether that's in full swing now or not, I don't know. But I do think that we will get to that point.
Well, I certainly agree with you. And that presentation you put out, and the reason I want to get into this is because I think psychology is really important. And the thing that drew me to you after I saw that presentation was you were outlining many of the things that after, and I'm talking painful, I'm talking consternation, I'm talking going back and having to recheck the very foundations of the what your philosophies are built on, because we played it really well through the financial crisis, actually made not tons, but made decent returns in 08, 09, and then did really well up into 2011. It was probably one of the worst things that happened to me because I started thinking that the way that I see things is I've got the touch, right? Then as equity markets kept rallying and the dollar didn't have this perilous fall, I dug in my heels for about 2 years, posted some really bad performance, and out of frustration just started ripping apart my entire construct and trying to figure out what I was missing. And when I started coming to some of these conclusions is when I ran into your piece, Step Into Liquid, and I went, and I think I DM'd you or emailed you and just said, hey, out of nowhere, hey, will you come on the radio? We gotta compare notes. We gotta cross reference things. And one of the things that I have seen is a lot of this vociferous belief and this ardent belief that the dollar is going to zero. I tend to see it, no offense to anybody out there, but I tend to see it more in people that are individual investors or research minded. Because if you manage money for a living, and this is the lesson that I learned, was you got to be able to pivot and admit when you're wrong and try to figure out what you missed. And that's what led me on my journey of discovery about looking into, wait a second, I know that it should, but what am I missing here? Is that sort of the path that you went down? Did you go through a similar experience?
Yeah, very, very, very similar. And, there's a very fine line between sticking to your guns and not admitting when you're wrong, right? And it is admittedly a very, very fine line. And, it's very possible that right when you admit that you were wrong, it swings in your favor. Yeah.
Right.
But at the end of the day, there's that famous saying, I don't remember who it was. They were having a debate and he said, you change your mind. He says, yeah, well, when the facts change, I change. What do you do?
Right.
And, some of the facts were changing. And, I think one thing the mistake that I made, and therefore I think the mistake that other people make and continue to make, and I don't want to sound, I don't want to sound condescending here, and I don't want to sound like, I'm enlightened and everybody else is still in the dark ages, because, that's not where this is coming from.
Right.
But I think one of the biggest things to come to grips with is that when you do an analysis on something and you spend a lot of time and effort on it and you come to a conclusion, it's very hard to just throw all that work away. Right.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of a sunk cost at that point. You want it to be right. And along those lines, I think that one of the things that people tend to do is they'll do all this work on a specific topic and they may do actually very good, exceptional analysis. And I'll give an example on the United States and the United States' financing and what that means for the dollar. Because the U.S. has managed its budget and its finances in an absolutely horrible fashion. We've borrowed more money, than anybody in history. And there's no way in hell that we can pay it back. There's really only two options. We either have to default on the debt or we have to inflate it away. It's just really simple math. Okay. So now that's actually pretty good analysis. And the people that come to that conclusion, I commend them because, I agree with that. The problem is that it's very narrow. And what I mean by very narrow is that, yes, you have just done a fantastic analysis on the United States. But the problem is that it's a global economy. And the UK, have you done that same analysis on the UK? You know, have you done the same analysis on Australia? Have you done the same analysis on Europe? Have you done the same analysis on China or Japan or Australia or Brazil? Because when you do that, you realize that they are in just as much trouble as we are.
Yep.
And then when you step back and you say, okay, you know, these fiat currencies are in trouble, I need to own some gold. Okay, so now you've made the decision, which I think is a wise one, to own some gold. Now, do you want to own 100% of your portfolio in gold? I happen to think that that's silly. I don't want to own 100% of my gold or of my portfolio in gold. Okay, so let's pretend that you are, you know, predisposed to own gold. So now you own 15 or 20% in your portfolio in gold, which is actually still a fairly hefty allocation.
Yeah.
So let's say you've done that. Okay, so now you've still got 80%. You've taken care of your gold allocation. You no longer have to worry about being completely exposed to these fiat currencies, and you've still got 80% of left of your portfolio. And then you look at all these currencies and you realize, okay, we've already got our gold allocation, so let's remove gold from the equation. Now we've got 10, let's just use, we've got 10 different fiat currencies, right? The money, and let's say the whole world goes and puts 20% of their portfolio in gold, right?
Yeah.
Gold goes through the roof, it's all good. But there's still 80% of money that has to go somewhere else, right? And you look at these fiat currencies, and so all that money is going to go, or a lot of that money is going to flow to where they think it's going to be treated best out of those fiat currencies. So now you've got 10 fiat currencies, and the reality is one of those 10 fiat currencies, even though they're all really bad, one of them is going to do better than the other nine. That's just the way it works when you compare things. You know, if you had 10 football players and they were all horrible, one of them would still be the best, right?
Right.
You know, 10 race cars and they were all really fast or they were all really slow, one of them's still going to be faster than the other. And that's kind of what I mean by narrow analysis versus broad analysis, and that you may have done all the work you possibly could on one of those individual cars, but if you don't have some idea of what's going on with the other nine, you're not really going to understand what goes on in the overall race. And that's when I finally did that. That's when I finally came to the realization that even if gold goes up and goes through the roof, one of these other fiat currencies is going to do the same thing. And all the work I did led me to believe that that's going to be the dollar. You know, and I don't probably have time to go through all the reasons that is today, but suffice to say, there's a number of things that influence the rest of the world to use dollars. Even if they don't like it, even if they hate it, even if they think the U.S. is an evil empire, they still, for a number of reasons, need to use dollars. And it's for those reasons that I think that the dollar, when we get into this, you know, crisis, the dollar will not just go up, but go up kind of in a very asymmetric fashion. And I think that's going to cause all kinds of problems for the rest of the world.
Well, yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. The other thing that I find a bit confounding about this argument is unless your thesis is the dollar is going to lose something like, you know, 30, 40, 50% of its value over a 6-month period of time. Let's say that our buddies on the dollar bear side of it are right. What is the impact of a 15 to, I mean, assuming it's somewhat orderly, a 15 to 20% devaluation over, let's say, a 12 to 16 month period of time. Brent, I don't really see that as causing any problems. In fact, I think that you would probably see U.S. and global equity markets go berserk, wouldn't you?
Most likely. It kind of depends on what was the method and the speed and the you know, what were the catalysts that led to the dollar doing that.
Right.
But yeah, most likely that would happen. And here's the thing with the dollar going lower is the dollar going lower actually helps the world continue on at its status quo. You know, continue to do all these crazy things that we've been doing. The whole world knows that the system, I shouldn't say the whole world, not all, the monetary authorities, you know, the bank, the central bank, they know that if the dollar gets out of control, you know, it's just not going to be good for the global monetary system. The IMF has come out and said this. The Bureau of International Settlements has come out and said this. There's a whole theory that goes back to, I think, the 50s or 60s, an economist named Robert Triffin talked about Triffin's dilemma, and that is that the Trippins and Dilemma says that eventually, whoever has the global reserve currency, there will come a time where the needs of the global economy come into conflict with the needs of the domestic economy. And when that happens, you're going to have a crisis because, if the global reserve country chooses the international market over the domestic market, then the domestic market's going to suffer. If they choose the domestic market over the international market, then the international market's going to suffer. And Trump, anybody remember what his tagline is? Make America great again. So he's going to let the rest of the world suffer if it means, if making America great again means the rest of the world has to suffer, well, then he doesn't really care what happens to the rest of the world. So we're kind of moving right into the heart of Trippin's dilemma here. It's funny because Trump wants a weaker dollar because he wants to rebuild the manufacturing base. But a number of the policies that he put in place have actually helped strengthen the dollar. So, you get into this situation where even though, monetary authorities, presidents, central bankers, they have an idea of what they want and how to do it, but you start getting all these unintended consequences. And I think the point that I would like to make, which kind of relates to this question, is that if you are one thing I want to make clear is that a lot of people who are dollar bears believe in precious metals. Now, not everybody, but maybe they believe that, you got to own real assets or gold, or maybe you own equities because, the dollar is going to lose its value. And therefore, those real assets and those real companies are going to go up in value. Because they understand that, you need to own gold, or because you understand how currencies get inflated away, that, you're a contrarian. And because out there owns gold, and because you do, you're a contrarian. Well, just because you own gold as a contrarian, and I would agree that in general, gold is a contrarian view. The dollar going lower is not a contrarian view.
Right.
I want to clear this up because a lot of people I talk to think that they're contrarians and they think the dollar is going lower. The whole world thinks that the dollar is going lower. All the monetary authorities will tell you that the dollar needs to go lower. The Fed will work to make the dollar go lower. Donald Trump will tell you that the dollar is going lower. I just did a survey of 33 different financial institutions. 32 of them said that the dollar is going lower. If you go on the commitment of traders and you look at how people are positioned, the speculation for the dollar going higher is near its all-time low. So the dollar under no means is frothy and that everybody is extremely bullish the dollar. And in fact, it's the opposite. And part of the reason is that if the dollar goes over, it blows the monetary system up. So it's kind of a problem. It's kind of like that too big to fail thing. It's such a big problem that nobody actually wants to consider that it could even happen.
Right.
But my point is just because it's not good if it happens, and just because a lot of people would be upset if it happened, doesn't mean it's not going to happen. And I just happen to think that there's been a number of things that have been put into motion that's going to make it happen. So. I guess my point, it's fine if you have the opposite view of me. It's fine to be a dollar bear, but just don't think that you're a contrarian if that's what you're doing. And there's no reason you have to be a contrarian. There's a lot of people think that there's a lot of wisdom in crowds. And if the crowd thinks the dollar going lower and you get in that crowd and the dollar goes lower, there's nothing wrong with that. So I'm not using this as a negative thing. I just want to point out, just understand what you're talking about when you say whether you're a contrarian or whether you're consensus.
Couldn't agree more. We got to take a quick break, but when we get back, I want to dig into something you said there you said, look, if that happened, it's a disaster. Dollar surging in price. It would wreak havoc on the monetary system. That's why a lot of people don't think it'll happen. I tend to approach that from more of a contrarian view, meaning when I identify an Achilles heel in markets, I sit there and I think to myself, I don't know when, but if I'm identifying that weakness, the markets will too at some point, and it's almost inevitable. So. I want to dig into that when we get back. So everybody stick with us. We got to take a quick break. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH. All right. Thank you so much and welcome back. And we're going to dig right into it here with Brent Johnson of Santiago Capital. Brent, right before we left, you said something that I teased a little bit, and I look at and forgive me while I go down this list here, because it smacks to me of the financial crisis in this way. that so many of the hopes and dreams on markets, you know, they got so fraught. Well, real estate was frothy. Equity markets were nowhere close to where they are now. But 06, 07, the faith and the belief that this could extend was this foundational belief that real estate could not go down across the entire country at the same time. And then if you ask somebody, well, what if it did? You know, they'd acknowledge, well, it'd be a disaster, but it's never happened before, right? You and I remember those conversations well. And that's sort of why my time in markets, I've looked and when I identify an Achilles heel or a button, if it gets pushed, it's going to wreak havoc. I sit there and I go, it's only a matter of time until markets sniff that out. And that Achilles heel will be, it'll present itself. It's going to prove frail. And it'll happen. And that's why I look at the world today and this whole dollar going down argument, I kind of sit there and look at them and I go, guys, that's not going to pose a lot of problems. It's going to be again, if it's measured and it's orderly to some degree, mm-hmm. it's going to happen and it happens over a period of time. It's going to be a vacation for the world. I got in a back and forth on Twitter about this with a guy where he said, you know, who's going to be there to bail out the U.S. dollar? And I looked at him and I go, every central bank in the world, because if the U.S. consumer loses their purchasing power and can't buy goods, their economy's going in the tank, too. How many BMWs are going to get sold in the United States if the real price of a BMW on an inflation adjusted basis doubles? Not many, you know. Do you see it similarly where if we identify this horrible outcome that we can see, you know, DXY goes to 120, 130, Katie bar the doors. Doesn't that make it somewhat inevitable?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's the crisis, right? That is the thing that throws a monkey wrench in everything is the dollar going higher.
Right.
That is the dollar going higher in a disorderly fashion blows up the world.
Yeah.
And that is the crisis that forces monetary authorities and central bankers to change the policies that they've been doing, or to change the monetary system, or to reset the currencies, or to write off the debts, or whatever it is, right? But that's the crisis. You know, central bankers and monetary authorities, they don't act ahead of time. They react to crisis. That's just kind of how it's always been. You know, the dollar going lower and in an orderly fashion is a way for the monetary system to, as currently designed, to continue functioning, but just at much higher prices for individuals, right? As currencies get debased.
Yeah.
But part of the problem, and I'm gonna move on to a little bit a related topic, but it comes back to this, is that part of the reason that I believe the dollar is going much higher is the dollar debt in the world. Now, everybody hears about, and part of the reason that a lot of people think the dollar is going lower is all the debt that the United States has borrowed, right? We're $23 trillion in debt. You include the off-balance sheet, the liabilities, and, you know, entitlement programs, it's $100 trillion or $200 trillion. You hear all these different numbers. Whatever it is, we can't pay it off, right? And listen, that's a huge issue. The fact that we have a $22 trillion national debt and we have a trillion-dollar budget deficit, and it's probably going to $2 trillion or $3 trillion budget deficit, that's horrible things. But the fascinating thing to me is that, forget the United States for a second, the rest of the world, entities outside the United States, have something like $13 or $14 trillion of U.S. dollar-denominated debt. So that is demand for dollars. So even if these other countries don't want to use the dollar any longer, or don't like the dollar, or hate Donald Trump, or whatever their reason, right, they still have these dollar liabilities that they have. Now, a lot of countries and entities took these loans out over the last 10 years, especially after QE ramped up post the global financial crisis. Because, you know, the theory was the dollar was going to lose value as they pumped all this currency into the market.
Hey, Brent,
down 10 or 15%.
Let me stop you right there, because we're up against a hard break, and I want you to continue this thought. So if you can hold on to this through the break, come back And I'll let you continue. Sorry about that. But anyway, everybody, we got to take a quick break. Stick with us. We'll be back. And we are going for another hour. We got an extra bonus hour this week. So stick with us through the break and we'll be right back. And I will get Brent, the rest of Brent's thought on this topic. So stick with us. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH. All right, welcome back to the show. And for those of you tuning in at one, you're sitting there going, welcome back. What did I miss? This week was a special two-hour deal. So you might need to go back to the podcast page to hear the beginning part of the show. And we are midway in our interview with Brent Johnson. So again, I'd encourage you to go to mynorthwest.com. You can go to, you can Google Know Your Risk Stitcher. You can just Google Know Your Risk Radio. You're going to find a bunch of different podcasts. And I want you to hear this interview that we're doing with Brent. He's been kind enough to join us on the show today because we're talking about, to me, you know, kind of the central point of what's going on in markets and what I think will continue to drive them as we go forward. So, Brent, let's get right back into it. And you were right in the middle of something that I think is important. If you could pick up where you left off and continue on with that thought, I would be much appreciated.
Sure. So one of the main drivers of the dollar going higher in the year ahead, in my opinion, is the amount of U.S. dollar debt in the world. But despite the fact that the United States owes $23 trillion in national debt, the rest of the world, entities outside of the United States, have borrowed about, you know, there's different figures, anywhere from $13 to $15 trillion of debt in U.S. dollars. So it's right. denominated in U.S. dollars, even though it's not their home currency. Now, a lot of these entities did this over the last 10 years, you know, after the global financial crisis, when the United States was doing these massive QE programs. The idea was that they can borrow in dollars, and because the dollar is the global reserve currency, they can borrow at a lower rate. You know, some of these emerging markets or international countries could issue debt at a lower rate because it was a dollar. And the dollar was in more demand than their own currency, so they could, you know, they could borrow cheaper. Not only that, but they thought that as the dollar lost value over the subsequent 10 or 20 years, the currency would fall 10, 20, 30%, and they would be able to pay it off easier. Well, the problem is that didn't happen. They took out all this debt. They owe all this dollars, but not only did the dollar not fall, but the dollar went up 15 or 20%. And so, you know, now those loans are starting to come due over the next 2 or 3 years. The maturity schedule on all these international loans begins to spike. And so not only do these countries and these entities have to roll this dollar debt, they have to do it at higher prices, and they have to do it at a time when their countries are already and their industries are already under pressure economically. So you get into this, if you took out a student loan, and 10 years later you found out that you actually owed more than you borrowed, because, you know, the currency value had gone up, you know, that's a problem, right? And yeah. So, you know, this is a real issue. And that's why I say whether people want to leave the dollar or not, wanting to and having the ability to are two completely different things. You know, I hear this all the time that, you know, these countries are going to de-dollarize. They're going to start trading their own currencies. They're going to set up bilateral agreements with other countries to avoid the dollar. Well, that's fine, but they still owe $14 trillion of U.S. dollars. So they need to get those dollars in order to pay it off. And so then people say, yeah, but when they de-dollarize, they'll just default on these loans and they won't need them anymore. Okay, so there's two parts of this. Number one, the United States is either their first or biggest second customer, whether it's China or the United States, but we're one of the two. And I don't know too many businesses that do well when they lose either their first or biggest second customer. And if they default on their dollar debt, you know, they're going to have a hard time doing business with the United States after that. The second thing is that if they were to do that and just default on the debt, because money in today's system is loaned into existence.
Yes.
One man's debt is another man's asset. If you start defaulting on that debt, the assets evaporate and the money supply evaporates. So even though the demand for dollars is going down as people de-dollarize, the supply of dollars is going down at a much faster rate.
Yep.
So if you have demand falling but supply falling even faster, that's a formula for price to rise. So that's another reason why I think the dollar is going higher. It doesn't matter whether they take out more loans or whether they default on the loans. The demand for the dollar is still there, and there's real no viable alternative. And, you know, the third reason, which we haven't really talked about before, but which is maybe one of the most important things, is, you know, if countries want to de-dollarize and, you know, start doing things against the United States and putting trade agreements in against the United States, you know, many times throughout history, this has been attempted. And it's not a necessarily a popular or a nice topic, but, you know, the dollar system is enforced by the U.S. Marines and the U.S. Army and the Air Force and the Navy. You know, the countries that have tried this have not fared well. You know, just look at Libya. Look at Allende from Central America when you know, several years ago he tried it. Look at the Iraq, you know.
Venezuela.
These are countries that tried to buck the – look at Iran just recently, right?
Yeah.
These are countries that have been trying to buck the dollar system. And, again, I don't really like it. I don't think it should be this way, but it is, you know.
Yep.
And so, you know, if you think that with someone like Trump in the White House that a country or a number of countries are just going to leave the dollar – and Trump is going to sit back and say, okay, no problem. I mean, it's just, to me, it's a little bit naive. It just really doesn't work that way. Now, will it eventually happen? Yeah, when countries and central banks are actually forced to make a change, then they will. And, you know, that's going to be a very ugly day. But I think when that happens, the dollar goes higher before it goes lower.
Well, and this is my argument, and getting back to the first interview we had you on and why I started stalking you cyber to get you on the show at the beginning was this is the way my train of thought started when I was doing what I was saying earlier about ripping down my foundations and starting afresh. Because, you know, when you're an asset manager like you and I are, you know, you can stick to you can quote unquote stick to your guns, but that better turn pretty quick or you're not going to have a business for much longer. And, you know, you got to adjust. And I started seeing all this and started, you know, it was the military observation. And then also, I think that when I look at the landscape, I said, yes, eventually the dollar is going to collapse like every fiat currency has in history. But what is going to dethrone it? What is going to be the final move? What is going to be the checkmate, if you will, on the dollar that will actually make it not the world reserve currency anymore? And I didn't like coming to this conclusion because it was completely conflicting my worldview at the time. But it was, if the dollar gets too strong, that would be the reason to make it no longer the world reserve currency, because if it gets weak, it's a problem for nobody, maybe a little bit for the U.S. consumer. Go ahead.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
And I furthermore, you think about the political will involved, because I think at this point, because of the military situation, again, looking at the chessboard the way it is currently, if you want to dethrone the dollar, the U.S. is going to have to go along. The only way the U.S. agrees or gets the political backing or the political will to do that is if the strong dollar has crushed the global economy. So what the argument that I have made for a long time is, look, I think the dollar is going to get dethroned, but I don't think it's going to be by force. I think it's going to be something that our politicians go along with willingly at the time. What do you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately what's going to happen is the dollar is going to, you know, over the next couple of years, it's going to go up and it's going to spike and it's going to get back to levels where it's not good for anybody. It's not good for the United States. It's not good for Europe. It's not good for South America. It's not good for China, right? And so the world will come together, I think, and come up with either a new system or they will. I mean, I think the rest of the world is going to beg us to devalue the dollar.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I don't think they're going to be upset when we do it.
I
think they'll probably ask us to do it.
Yeah. Granted, it's not a spike, but, you know, emerging markets, I say EEM because I think about it in terms of tickers, but you look at emerging markets, I mean, they've been absolutely routed over the last 3 years. And then look, all of a sudden they get off the mat in the same year that the Fed cuts rates 3 times and puts the standing repo facility in. Right. I mean, everybody's cheer. The minute the Fed cranks up the liquidity and starts doing things that would typically be currency negative, the rest of the world perks up. You know, like you said, they'd be cheering us along.
Yeah, exactly. No, exactly. And you know, I've had this discussion with many people that, you know, Trump constantly says he wants a lower dollar. He thinks it's too strong. It's unfair. It's unfairly penalizing us versus other countries. Other countries manipulate their currencies lower and that they're cheating. And, you know, he doesn't like that. And, And I hear where he's coming from. And, you know, that's kind of the most, you know, politicians and central bankers, they don't want hard money because they want the ability to, you know, spend,
right,
you know, in order to get reelected. And, you know, hard money makes it harder for them to do that. But I've had this discussion with many people that whether or not Trump knows that a strong dollar actually helps him more than whether it hurts him. I actually think he does know. A lot of people disagree with me. And I think he would prefer a weaker. And this is my thing with Donald Trump, too. I think Donald Trump likes to make deals, right?
Yep.
And you can't make a deal with somebody who absolutely hates you and has no interest in doing business with you, right?
Yeah.
And so I think he's an egomaniac, so he wants people to like him, right?
Yeah.
So I think he wants to do trade deals where it's kind of somewhat of a win-win for everybody. But if he can't get it that way, then I don't think he has any problem getting what he wants, being a bully. So I think he wants this whole thing to go with a weaker dollar. But I actually think he does know that if he needed to, he could use the strong dollar as a weapon. And I always say, like, heaven help the world if he ever actually starts doing that. Because he could win the whole China trade negotiation deal with one sentence. All he would have to say is, okay, fine, we're going to let the dollar appreciate by 15 or 20%, and let's see how the rest of the world deals with that. Done. Don't say anything else. You know, in 6 months, everybody would be at the table, you know, begging.
Yeah,
because they just can't handle a stronger dollar. You know, now I'm not saying that would be great for the United States either, but on a relative basis, we would be able to handle that hardship better than the rest of the world.
Yeah, well, it's kind of the Trump, and I agree with you. It's kind of the Trump's version of plata o plomo, right? The silver or lead. I'm just blanking out. The guy down in Colombia, the drug lord that they took out years ago.
Escobar.
Escobar. Good golly. Mine just went blank. But no, I agree with you. It's, hey, we can do this easy or we can do this hard. We're going to do it one way or the other. And I think his negotiations with China are a perfect example of that. He's going to, as long as he's at the reins, he's going to get it one way or the other. Now, shifting a little bit, what do you think? So looking back at 2013, it's gotten us to record valuations across the board. PE is lagging a little bit, but we're still at a cycle high now at PE, if not at a cycle high, very close to it. You know, GDP market cap, Buffett yardstick has reached, you know, has eclipsed the highs in 99. What do you think is the reason for that? And is that purely just a reflection of three rate cuts in the standing repo facility that was put in September?
Zach, I'm really sorry. I kind of lost my train of thought with that question. But what was the question again?
Okay.
I apologize.
Hey, no problem. So what I was saying is we look at the markets last year. We've rallied to new all-time highs. We've got, you know, 9 out of 10 valuation metrics at all-time highs. Buffett yardstick, market capitalization or GDP to market capitalization, in new record highs, eclipse the highs in 99, historic year, 30% up on the S&P, yet earnings are essentially flat, a little bit up. What do we attribute that to? Do is that purely a product of three Fed rate cuts and the standing repo facility being put in September, or is there something else going on?
Well, if we're just talking this year, I think what you just said has a lot to do with it. If we're talking over the last 2 or 3 years, you know, I think it's a little bit something different. Now, so let me kind of address both of them, if that's all right.
Yep.
So, you know, when I put out that, you know, step into liquid presentation in 2016, part of the reason that I thought the dollar would get stronger is we had, on a relative basis, higher rates than the rest of the world. I thought that as dollars flowed into the U.S., that would be supportive of U.S. assets. About a year after I put that one out, then I started talking about this, you know, the milkshake theory, for lack of a better word.
And, yep.
Late 2017, early 2018, I kind of started developing in more detail, and I said that as U.S. asset rates are higher than the rest of the world, and as we draw those funds won't just stay in cash; they will, you know, get invested into the stock market and the real estate market, and it would push U.S. asset prices higher. And we saw that a lot in 2018. You know, when I kind of first went out and did my first first or second kind of big interview where I kind of laid out the whole theory that I'd been developing. It was May of 2018, and I believe that the Dow was around 21 or 22,000, somewhere in that range.
Sounds right.
And I said, listen, this is all going to end very badly. I want to make absolutely clear. I'm not suggesting people go buy stocks because things are good. I'm suggesting that they go buy stocks because things are bad and they're going to get worse. And the reason was is because I thought as things got bad that people started to seek out safe havens, U.S. equities on a relative basis around the world would start to look like a safe haven to other places. And the fact that we had higher rates, would help suck dollars in. And so, a lot of people at the time said, you're crazy. The valuations are insane. We've gone up for 4 or 5 years in a row. Toward now 22,000, the Dow's tripled since, the global financial crisis. And I said, listen, you missed the whole point of the argument. I agree with you. Everything's bad, but I think equities are going up because of that. And so now here we are at 30,000, right?
Yeah.
So that turned out to be a pretty decent call. Now I'd say over the last 6 months, And I guess I would say, the move from, 22 to 25, 26, 27,000 was kind of more what I was talking about there. And I'd say the last 2,000 or 3,000 has really been when this liquidity came back from the rest or from the central banks or from the Fed specifically. Sorry. We had that big pullback in the market about 13 months ago, 14 months ago. I had a much clearer vision for 2019 after we had that pullback in 2018 than I have right now for 2020. Because I really believed in my theory, when we had that pullback in 2018, I was buying fairly aggressively into equities, and that paid off very well last year. Now we're kind of back to we're back to the all-time high in the market. We've got the Fed supplying liquidity again. The valuations are even higher, bank profits or corporate profits are not as high as they were. Some of the earnings are starting to fall. So therefore valuations are higher. And I kind of get a kick out of all these different things that go around on Twitter and social media and on, CNBC and stuff about valuations and et cetera, because, listen, if you don't know the valuations are high, you just simply haven't been paying attention.
Right.
People have been saying valuations are high for 3 or 4 years. So I'm not going to argue that valuations are high. They are high. The question is whether they're going to get higher or not. I happen to believe now I would actually love it if we had another pullback here. I think it would be healthy. I thought we would be up in 2019. I didn't think we'd be up 30%. I was thinking we'd be up 18, 20, 22%. So this last 10% has been a little bit of a surprise to me so soon. But ultimately, I think we're going even higher than this. I think we're going to end up, Dow 40,000, maybe even higher than that. That I don't think it's going to be a straight line. I think it would be helpful if we had a correction. I would actually prefer if we had a correction. But my argument does not base itself upon, valuations. I think we're going to get into a period of time where valuations are completely thrown out. They're going to hit all-time highs. And it's not going to be the market melting up on fundamentals. It's going to be the market melting up as a melt up in the dollar and a melt up in U.S. dollar based assets. Again, equities going higher because things are bad and people are scared of everything else rather than going up because they are good. So I don't know if that's a good way to answer your question or not, but that's kind of how I see it.
No, it is. And I think the most important thing to reinforce to listeners, whether it's the show or the podcast, is that, knowing the way you think and have interviewed you several times, I in no way is either one of us sitting here saying, look, go in with reckless abandon. There's no risk. Go buy equities hand over fist. But this, again, it reminds me so much of the similar paths you and I came to these realizations. And I get it. I'm a value-oriented guy. These values are preposterous. They make my stomach hurt. But there's an interesting thing. There was a tweet put out by Neil Kashkari, who's the vice president of the Minneapolis Fed. Is that what he is?
No, he's. I think he's the head of the Mini.
Oh,
he's
is he?
Governor of the Mini. Yeah.
Oh, Neil's moving on up in the world, man. But he put out this tweet where he was saying that, look, all these repo these QE conspiracy theory guys, I don't see how this bleeds into equity prices at all. And I chuckled when I read that, because if you want to break it down to brass tacks, and again, feel free to disagree with me. And this is hard for me to admit as a value related guy, but I look at Fed activity, the repo facility notwithstanding. I mean, I think that's a perfect example. I look at the Fed cuts. What is that? I mean, I look at it, and when I see that activity, I think to myself, look, yeah, there's knock-on currency effects and all that kind of stuff, but essentially what these guys are doing is selling volatility. And if we look at the suppression of volatility over the last 10 years, it's been historically low. It's been about, I think the average volatility level over the last, 8 or 9 years has been something, somewhere between, right around 13, 14, maybe. Historically, it's at 20. If Fed activity is aimed, and then why does the Fed step in? Why do central banks step in? They typically step in when volatility goes up, right? So they're suppressing volatility. Yep. If we are changing or attempting to, or during a period of time where they've got the ability to do this, if they're suppressing volatility lower than its historical averages, then that would inherently justify higher prices. Now, I'm not saying that's going to last or that's permanent. It certainly isn't. Yeah. But would you agree with that? I mean, if you've...
Yeah,
if,
I mean, I think, yeah, it was exactly, I mean, Neil might be the king of being disingenuous.
Right.
The fact that they don't think that providing liquidity has helped asset prices rise is just, it's ridiculous, right? I mean, there's really no other way to say it.
Yeah.
Of course. I mean, because, if the market didn't need liquidity to go higher, then they wouldn't be providing it, right?
Right.
And if you pulled this liquidity facility back, stock prices would more than likely be even lower. So, I think it's very disingenuous of him to come out and say that. And again, the point is, listen, it is really, really hard right now. And I'm not, a lot of times, we come on these shows and we espouse our ideas and people think, oh, wow, these guys sound smart. Or maybe some people think we sound stupid. But the reality is it's very hard. We don't know what's going to happen. Nobody knows what's going to happen.
Nope.
And if you take this job, there's a lot of people, unfortunately, in this business who really just, they collect a paycheck and they, they put their clients in some mutual funds or ETFs and don't even really think about it, right? But if you're trying to be like a good fiduciary and really trying to help your clients, I mean, it's really hard right now because, where do you go? And the reality is, unless you just go to cash, which I would argue is not necessarily a great thing to do, you've got to go somewhere. Real estate's at its all-time high. Fixed income is not at its all-time high, but pretty close, right? We've got, we don't have $15 trillion of negative yielding bonds. I think it's down to $11 trillion, but they're still, we're still at 5,000-year lows on interest rates. So that means fixed income has a higher level of risk than perhaps it historically has. Now, listen, that doesn't mean that interest rates aren't going to zero and bonds might go up a lot more, but I'm just saying that on a long-term valuation basis, bonds aren't exactly cheap either.
No.
Stocks are at their all-time highs. Gold has come roaring back. If you buy gold stocks, and again, I don't have a problem with people buying gold stocks, but just you're at the 6 or 7 year highs now, right?
Yeah.
So again, everything you're buying now is not on a long-term basis. I'd say the gold stocks are cheap, but on the last 5 or 6 year basis, they've rocketed up. So where do you go that at least in the short term is not overbought? And I think you probably have exposure to all these places. My point is if you're a thoughtful fiduciary of client capital, it's really hard to figure out what to do. And I think it's very important to have a viewpoint and to have an idea of where you want to go and have a roadmap of how you're going to get there. But I think it's probably more important than ever to be flexible in your thinking, to be willing to pull off the road and just sit on the side for a while, maybe drive a little slower than you typically drive. But, the reality is that if you're in our business, you don't have the ability to just drive into the driveway and sit there forever. At some point you got to get on the road and go. Now you can do it thoughtful and you can do it smart and you're welcome to avoid certain roads. But my point is all the roads seem a little bit dicey right now. So it's not as easy as maybe sometimes you think that we think it is. At least me, I don't think it's easy by any means.
Oh, hey, pal. Yeah. I second that 100%. No, it's and in a lot of ways, I think one of the toughest parts about it is a guy that's studied a lot of financial history and grew up in the industry, grew up in a brokerage firm. So much of what we learn, so much of what we've been indoctrinated with, that was, you know, and I don't mean indoctrinated in a bad sense, but it's so much of the, you know, the Buffett and the Graham and, you know, all these things. With this monetary policy run amok, it's thrown a lot of it out the window. And I think that if you don't have the self-awareness and the humility to sit back and question even the things that you're the most sure about, you know, I think you're doing 100 in a 35 mile an hour zone, and it's only an eventuality until you have a nasty crack up. So in our last 4 minutes here, as we are up against time.
Yep.
You said you didn't have, and I didn't want to hear this because I was hoping for some insight from you, but you said you're a bit blank on 2020. What are you watching? I know that you think the world is a one-way trade right now. It's U.S. dollar. I agree with you. But what do you think 2020 has in store, and what are the things that you're keeping an eye closely on this year?
Yeah, okay, so there's a couple things. First of all, of course, you got to look at equities, right? I still have exposure to equities. I do have a few hedges on because I think that I just think it's a time that makes sense to drive a little bit slower, like I was saying.
Yep.
I would actually welcome, you know, kind of a pullback here. You know, we had a pretty good year last year, but you know, things are extended. But you know what? Things were extended, you know, 2 years ago, 3 years ago. So I still use my overall, you know, milkshake thesis, the dollar melt up, U.S. assets melt up, as my roadmap. That's where I think we're ultimately headed. But I do have to say that, you know, there's some storm clouds on the horizon, and my vision just isn't as clear right now. I have to be honest. I think we will likely get some kind of a pullback in the equity market here in the first half of the year. But it would not surprise me at all, you know, if by the end of the year or, you know, this time next year, we're back at all-time highs. It wouldn't shock me at all if we just kind of went sideways on a number of markets between now and the election. You know, the things that I'm looking at most are, you know, I have this long-term chart of the Dow and the S&P, and it's a long-term channel, and we've actually broken out to the upside.
This is the – hold on. So the people are aware, though. This is – we have coined this now. This is the Brent Johnson channel.
That's right.
That's what I've named it.
And there you go. And you know, we've been bouncing up against it for a long, but we kind of broke through it. And so it wouldn't shock me at all to find that we, you know, pull back into that channel for a little while. I would love it if that happened, but listen, we might not. We might just keep going higher. I think you got to prepare for higher equity prices. So I'm watching that channel pretty closely. I'm watching the repo. So I'm going to try to get through this pretty quickly, but one of the interesting things about repo is that central banks, and Fed in particular, says they control the front end, right, of the curve, not the back end of the curve, and they can set interest rates. Part of the reason that this repo thing is a big deal is because if the Fed sets, interest rates at the front end, the federal funds rate at 1.75, or let's say they drop it to 1.5, but then the repo market is pricing, you know, short-term funding at 3% or 5% or 10% like it was in September, that shows that the Fed is losing control of the front end or the price of money, right? And that's not a good situation. So I'm watching that pretty closely. And my point is if the demand, the Fed, we could get into a situation, I'm not predicting this, I'm just saying we could get into a situation where it's hard for the Fed to cut rates in order to help the market higher, because the demand for repo is pushing short-term rates higher. The last thing the Fed wants to see is the Fed funds rate at 0.5 and the repo rate at 5, right?
Right.
Because that means they've just lost control. And so, you know, if we get into this period of time where the rest of the world is starting to slow down, we're starting to get capital to flow into the United States, like I think we eventually will, and that kind of puts pressure on, you know, short-term rates to go a little higher, it kind of makes it harder for the Fed to cut rates. And you could get into this situation where, you know, maybe our rates aren't dropping as fast as everybody thought they were going to. And therefore, you know, the higher yield on U.S. Treasuries still looks very good. relative to the rest of the world, and we just were off and running on, you know, this milkshake melt-up. So I'm kind of watching all that stuff. I would not be shocked at all to see us have to cut rates over the rest of the year and have a correction. I would welcome that. But ultimately, over the next 2 or 3 years, I think we're going much higher in U.S. dollar assets.
Yeah, well, I tend to, that's certainly the way I'm leaning, and I kind of, current markets sort of have a late 98, early 99 feel to me. We'll see if that's right. If I said it, it's probably not going to be. but, man, it just feels to me like we're at this infinity and beyond stage, and we're just gonna keep ripping. Anyway, Brent, well, hey, I can't thank you enough for coming on. Always a blast to have you on, and appreciate hearing your thoughts and your thoughtful responses to these questions, and hope you have a great day, great weekend. Hope that boy of yours starts feeling a little bit better. And thanks again for coming on, pal. I really appreciate it.
All right, man. I enjoyed it. Thanks again.
All right. Have a good one. All right, everybody. That was Brent Johnson with Santiago Capital, based out of San Francisco. You can hear Brent. He's become quite the financial voice. You can hear him on Real Vision. You can follow him on Twitter at @SantiagoAU, right, Brent? Is that the right Twitter handle?
AU Fund.
At @SantiagoAU Fund. Yes, and he's a great follow of mine, great information, great research he puts out. So anyway, thank you guys so much for sticking with us. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. Unfortunately, we can't say go Hawks anymore. I don't even want to get into this discussion while Brent's still on the air because he's a Niners fan. I apologize for him. But anyway, have a great weekend, and thank you for listening. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.